Education Committee and General Government Committee. I know we have a lot of people here today, and I appreciate the good showing of Oregonians here to look at this issue of online education and virtual education. Our original plan today was to hold a joint hearing on the House and Senate Education Committees, and we have some House members who are out there. If you'd like to join us up here, it's your choice. The idea was to do an overview for a while, and then we would take public hearing testimony on three Senate bills, and then we were going to do the same on some House bills. The House has decided not to do that part, and we're fortunate to have the chair here, Chair Gelser. Do you want to say anything?
Sure. Thank you, Senator Haas, and thanks to everyone that is here. And first of all, I want to apologize for any inconvenience that this has caused. As you know, this is a very difficult issue that impacts a lot of people, and it is really important that the process be very clear. And I think that that is particularly important for families who look at things that might be moving and want to know where things are going and where they're coming from. And unfortunately, sometimes as we post things, words matter a lot. And we ended up with public testimony on some hearings and invited testimony on others. And because we know that the work on this bill is going to start in the Senate, it made more sense to not take public hearing on House bills that will not be moving, and instead to keep the focus on the Senate bills, which is where the work is most likely to start. And then the House committee looks forward to taking up this issue when it comes over to the House side and continuing to work. And I know that we have great faith in the good folks on this committee and the many people who are interested in working on this. And again, I apologize for the tremendous inconvenience that this has caused, and the goal really was to create some clarity in what was becoming a very confusing process for a lot of people based on the questions that I was getting.
We appreciate that very much. Thank you, and welcome Representative Springer to you too. Representative Denbrough, thank you for being here. So let's start off with some overview testimony. We have Duncan Wise and Lori Satinspiel here. Your role is to set the stage.
Thank you, Chair Haas and members of the committee, along with a few of the House members. We're glad to see you. I'm Lori Satinspiel with the Oregon School Boards. Thank you for the opportunity for us to be before you this morning. With me today, I've brought Randy Harnish from our Policy and Legal Department. And the reason I brought Randy is because he fields several different types of questions from our districts regarding charter law and if a charter is going to go into effect, the drawing up of the contract, and the renewing of the contract. So I thought it important for him to be here to set the stage for the context, how the law works, and maybe the inconsistencies with the virtual overlay. Currently, we have 56 districts sponsoring 87 charter schools. There's an average charter school has 150 students. Right now, there's 14,000 students. 4,000 are in the virtual learners, and those are involved with 9 virtual schools. And just with that little bit of information, I want to just get right to the law and go to Randy to talk about it.
Good afternoon, Chair Haas, members of the committee. I'm Randy Harnish. I'm with the Oregon School Boards Association. I spent a fair amount of time prior to the School Boards Association working with the Department of Ed and had some experience working with the charter school law from that side as well. I wanted to just spend a minute or two and review kind of the context and where this issue actually falls in the kind of the larger scheme. I think you have a one-page document that you don't have.
Maybe.
Yeah. Maybe you do. Okay. Excellent. If you flip it over and look at the little Venn diagram at the middle of the back of the page, this topic really falls at the intersection of those three subjects: K-12 public education, A subset of the K-12 public education are all charter schools. All charter schools in Oregon law are public schools. The interesting set of questions that the virtual system creates is when you overlay the virtual on top of both the charter and the public. And so what we're really talking about is that little wedge of the charter school that intersects with the online education. Now, in Oregon general education law, the functional unit is a school district. And the school district is defined as a taxing district providing public elementary or secondary education or any combination thereof. A school district's authority extends to its geographic and political boundary. I was tempted to say geopolitical, but I just couldn't bring myself to say it. But that's as far as the school district's authority extends. That's also as far as the school district's responsibility extends. Example of that is that a school district is obligated to enroll all students between the ages of 5 and 19 who are residents of the district. They're not obligated to enroll students who reside somewhere else. Oregon's charter school law is a little bit different. The functional unit in a charter school, under charter school law, is the sponsoring school district, which is kind of practically defined as the district where the charter school is located and the district that has a contract with a chartering entity. A sponsoring school district, under charter school law, the authority and responsibility of the sponsoring district may extend beyond the school district's boundaries due to a couple unique provisions of the charter school law itself. The most important is that a charter school can enroll non-resident students without the resident district, that'd be the resident where the kid lives, and the sponsoring district's approval. In any other situation other than charter school, that kind of transfer would require the approval of both the attending district and the resident district. Students enrolled in a charter school, both resident and non-resident, can be counted by the sponsoring district for purposes of pulling down state school fund reimbursement. The law in 99 actually included a couple caps that tried to recognize that function. The first cap was that no more than 10% of the students in a district could attend a charter school, and the second was that at least 80% of the students in a charter school had to be residents of the sponsoring district. Those provisions both were sunsetted in 2003 and 2004. One little caveat is that under charter school law, there is an exception for educating non-resident students who are students with an individualized education program, an IEP, students who are receiving special ed. The law separates those students out and says that the responsibility for educating IEP students remains with the student's resident district, regardless of whether they're enrolled in a charter school in another district. Now, online education, and Chair Weiss is going to spend some time talking about the proposal, but basically, online education is not defined in Oregon law. It's referenced several places, but there's no real clean definition of online education. But we know that it is not limited by geography. It's not limited by how far parents are willing to transport their kids. It's not limited by the facility. It's not limited by how many kids you can put into a room without violating the fire code, occupancy rules. And we know that it is very quickly evolving along with technology, both in the accessibility. I mean, I carry a little iPod thing that allows me to link into the Internet wherever I can find a Wi-Fi hotspot. I mean, that's the kind of technology that, I mean, it's old already. In 5 years, who knows what that's going to look like. But it's also accessibility and sophistication. We're talking about the type of technology that is not just one way anymore, and it's not just one person at one end and another person at the other end. It's asynchronous, which means it's complex beyond what I can even describe. So we've got online education, we've got Oregon's charter school law, and we've got Oregon's general education law. Now, the State Board of Education has a role in the, with respect to the charter school provisions, in rulemaking authority, in hearing appeals of applications for charters that are denied, and in their waiver authority. And I think Duncan will talk about that in a little bit. Now, if you overlay charter school and online education, you really highlight two provisions of the charter school law that are key. The first is the charter school's ability to enroll non-resident students, resulting in an online charter school can enroll non-resident students from anywhere in Oregon. There is no longer that geographical, how far parents are willing to drive, practical limitation that was in everyone's mind when the bill was passed in 99. The second is that charter school enrollment is not capped. The online charters, enrollment is not limited by accessibility or the restrictions of facilities. Now, in 05, the legislature, in response to that, those concerns, imposed a 50% cap on charter schools that are offering online education, saying that at least 50% of an online charter school must be residents of the sponsoring district. That was an attempt to deal with those issues that exist in that little wedge of the charter school law that overlaps with online education. And I hope that little bit of an overview gives you an idea of kind of why the question exists and where it exists within the legal structure.
Mr. Harnish, this is excellent. This is the most succinct overview I've seen on this issue. And for those of you who haven't seen this one-page document, I highly recommend it, especially the for us visual-oriented learners, circles on the back help us make sense.
Any questions, Mr. Harnish? Okay, Mr. Wise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Duncan Wise. I'm the chair of the State Board of Education. I really want to thank you for inviting me to talk about an issue which we have been grappling with for the last several months, more than a year. And I come to you as a citizen board member who, much like you, has been confronted with a very complex issue. I see Mr. Denbrough here. He was an advisor to the board and saw a lot of our angst and discussions over a large part of this journey. And we are struggling with the issue of online learning. It's a new field in Oregon. What I'd like to do is really share with you a paper we've put together. It remains in draft form, and I think you've got it there. It tries to just lay out our current thinking, but it's really the product of well over a year of hearings and waiver requests and discussions we've had. And while I think it's an important piece of work to start with, it's very much still in draft, and I'm really using it more as a way of trying to share our learning with you and offering ourselves as a resource to you as you go through a similar set of questions, I suspect, and maybe we can provide a little guidance to how to at least approach the problem. So what I will do is briefly go through it, and I know you have a lot of hearings and a lot of additional witnesses, so I just want to touch on it and make myself available as you go through your work, but just to touch on a few points. First of all, I want to focus on the virtual aspect, and Randy did a great job of setting the legal stage, and then how it translates into the whole charter school question. The first thing I want to say, and again, I speak to you as a non-expert on this field, so I want to stress this, but here's how I see it. Online learning, first of all, is not one thing. I cannot stress that enough. There are huge varieties of forms and means of online learning, from individual classes to computer programs that may aid you, to full instruction, online learning with an instructor who's at a different point, teaching over the phone, over the computer, potentially with other students. There's a huge range of services, and frankly, we have no idea yet how it's all going to evolve. What I am convinced of is this is going to be an important part of the education landscape over the next 20, 30 years, and we are not. This is not the last hearing you will be holding on this. This is going to have large repercussions for the way education is delivered. We don't know exactly how or how it will evolve, and my guess is it will come to us in ways we can't even imagine yet in terms of what the actual education services look like. We've, in the early part of the report, tried to make that point. And I will just use two examples of the kinds of online learning we talk about. One is, and both I think are probably fairly familiar, one is the Oregon Virtual School that you created. What it is a set of curriculum that's available through the State Department of Education, and it is the department has acquired a variety of curriculum that are available to teachers in Oregon. But it is just the curriculum. The State Department of Education does not employ teachers, does not provide education services through the Oregon Virtual School. It is a set of virtual online curriculum. I've actually gone through one of the algebra classes. It's pretty good, but I would hope that, but for me to use it, I'd want to have a teacher backing me because when I had a question or two on it. But they are really good programs, and we've made that available. I take that to the other end of the spectrum where we have virtual full-time schools in Oregon, and in those cases, and I'll use SIO, which is one I'm sure you will be hearing about further today, which is a school. It's located in SIO. I visited the school. They're teachers. They teach students all over the state online, over the phone, over the internet. They have assignments. There's a curriculum associated with them. It's a school. And again, it's that kind of range of services we're talking about. And my guess is we're going to mix and match these in a whole huge range of ways as we look to the future. What makes it different, as Randy points out, and what makes it, if you will, disruptive, is the fact that the students and the teachers can be separated by geography, and so that you can have a teacher in one place in the state delivering a course to a student in another district, again, crossing district boundary lines. And that very fact creates a challenge to the structure of education delivery that we have in governance and budgeting and all those kinds of issues. So that's part one. Part two, as Randy said, is the charter school law. This form of learning does not have to occur through charter schools. It can, and lots of school districts provide online learning today. There's no particular reason it has to be done through charter schools. But we have seen some major developments through the charter school mechanism and law in Oregon, and which, of course, is leading to some of the policy debates that we're having before the board. And again, I think Randy articulated it very, very, very clearly. We have a number of charter schools that provide virtual online learning. Some live within the restrictions of the 50% rule. They don't serve more than 50% of the students outside the district boundaries. In three cases, we've given waivers for schools who want to serve outside the boundaries. And again, under the waiver provisions of the charter school statute, the board is charged with looking at waiver requests with a set of criteria and a direction to think broadly about innovation and needs of students. And so we have that responsibility under the charter school law. So that's the context that we're dealing with. As we've gone through these waiver requests that have been before us and are before us, we realize that we really do need to think about the policy framework and what the issues are. And so what this report then proceeds to do is raise a set of the issues, which I'm not going to run through with you, but about some of the major policy issues that we need to be facing in terms of thinking about this very complicated issue around governance and accountability, around teaching, about students and equity of students in the programs, about the program and how we assure quality, and about what the funding level should be. And again, as you can imagine, each of those issues are critically important, and we need to be considering all of them as we think about the policy and governance framework for delivery. What we have, with those issues in mind, what we did is created a set of principles for what we consider to be important as we think about a policy framework for delivering online learning, and you'll see those on page 11. And I'm not necessarily recommending these, you know, I'm sure you could quibble with the principles, but what I would recommend as you approach this problem, as you think about it in these forms of ways, in this way, what are you trying to accomplish? What are the issues and trade-offs? And then with those in mind, what are the different delivery models to think about? And how do they compare and contrast with the principles you've established? That's what we tried to do. And I use that as a framework as opposed to trying to dive into a detail on this. If you get into the details too quickly without stepping back and asking the fundamental questions, I think you're going to get lost. At least we got lost a couple, three or four times before we could step back. And that's really why we did step back, is to try to create this document. So the issues that we thought were important, first of all, is quality. We believe that the virtual online experience experience can provide a quality experience for at least some students in Oregon. Now, there's going to be a great debate on how many and who, but I think our analysis is there's certainly examples where this can be a really powerful learning tool for students in Oregon and should be available. Again, how wide that is going to be a matter of great debate. We also thought that, as Randy said, that the sending district has responsibilities for the students that they serve and that they ought to have a role to play in the students' choice and selection of whatever online service, if any, they take. The third, though, and sort of in competing value that we thought was important is that we do see the need for choices in services, that there are a wide variety of these and these services that can be available. We need to think about how to make choices available to districts and to students and their parents. We clearly want a system of accountability for both the money and the student performance. These schools need to meet state standards. They need to be assessed against state standards. We need to make sure they're quality, and we need to have oversight as we go forward to make sure that the programs are working. And frankly, these are so new, we need to have a way of monitoring progress and looking at what works and doesn't work as we move forward. So with those principles in mind, we then looked at some different models, and you'll see in the back, we looked at a lot of them, and I've just quickly touch on the three we discuss in that section of the report. At one end, we looked at what we might call the free market model. That would be to open it up with the charter schools to have a completely open system where any student could choose any charter school that's providing online learning in the state. And that would certainly open options. We think there's some issues around potential issues of quality. We really think there's a need for oversight on quality on behalf of the students and the taxpayers of Oregon. We think there are issues of the incentives individual districts might have in terms of running these programs, not necessarily in the best interests of students. In some states, that has been a problem. I'm not saying that's been a problem in Oregon, but it's certainly a possibility. And so we think there's some issues around that model. At the other end, you could leave things pretty much to the individual districts, basically restrict access and let individual districts decide. I think that risks stifling innovation, and I think you have some issues there at that other end. And so, as you can imagine, we're trying to find something that meets these competing needs, and that's the proposal that we've put in front of you. And to describe it again, without getting into the details, on the last page we have a schematic of what we're thinking about. And the idea that we had in mind was really twofold. One is a rule to districts that says you need to make available virtual online services to some students to be defined. And we need to set the ground rules. So districts see they have a responsibility providing those services. Concurrently, we also, through the State Board and the State Department of Education, adopt a set of providers. And they could be charter schools, nonprofits, they could be school districts, they could be ESDs who choose to offer these services. And then there becomes a contract between individual districts and individual providers to provide those services to the schools. That, in broad form, is what we're talking about, and with oversight of the providers by the department, but with also additional oversight at the district level. Now, a lot of details would need to flow from that proposal, and I understand that, and there's a lot working out. But what I would suggest to you is it's very important to have a basic vision of what you expect to happen as you go into this. There are other options. You can have a state-run program. Some states have looked at that. There are a variety of options. We think this one has some flexibility. At least we thought we'd put it out of the trial balloon for discussion. We're going to receive comments on this report. They're due next week. We'll share anything we receive with you. And again, to start where I began, we really appreciate you having a hearing on this. We want to be a partner with you and work with you as you deliberate on this really very important issue. Thank you.
And thank you. I very much appreciate your report. It's very thorough, and also appreciate the recommendations and the conclusions that you drew there. Any questions for Mr. Wise, Senator Cruz?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Duncan, on the waivers you've considered at this point, mm-hmm. some you have granted with conditions, mm-hmm. is there a... And I'm looking at the ones that are withdrawn, number one. Was there a general reason for withdrawal?
Well, you probably should talk. I mean, I'll give you my take, but I've got to be careful because I don't want to put words in others' mouths who probably are quite happy to explain. I mean, what we did, and just let me tell you what we did approve and what the conditions were, and that may give you a little.
Okay.
In the case of ORVA, virtual schools, we did adopt a conditional with conditions, and we limited the size to 600 students. We said the sending district must give permission for the students to enroll. So they, you know, there has to be an agreement with the sending district. We had a waiver until 2010, and we require third-party evaluation. We want to have good information about these programs, both how they're financial and student outcome information. We think that's all very important, and they agreed to do that. West Lane, we also granted a waiver. We limited to 100 students and no more than 75 outside the district. And again, that was, and they have, it's an interesting model. And again, West Lane, I think, illustrates the complexity. They're kind of a combination of, they use some local services and community-based services, but they also have a very large online component, so it's an interesting mix. My guess is in the future you're going to see more and more of that as we've looked at some of the other models that are emerging around the state where students use district services. It could be band, it could be sports, it could be a variety of things, but they also have a very large virtual component. And that's the nature of I think, of how these lines are likely to blur over time.
Bruce?
Yeah. Where are you in the process currently on Connections?
Connections has a waiver request before us. We just had a subcommittee here, a meeting this Monday. And honestly, I haven't actually talked to any of the board members. I got a brief report, but they're looking. They've made a request for a waiver just to remind you about Connections. Connections was in operation at the time that the 50% rule was established and has been operating since. When their contract became up for renewal, the Attorney General concluded, at our request, that they need a waiver to continue operation upon the renewal of the contract. And so we are right now in the process of reviewing that. And we've had a couple hearings with the school. We've been looking at their information, and we'll continue to proceed on that request. But I cannot tell you the timing or when. I'm looking forward to the report from the committee.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ms. Chair, and the reason for that question is I know the State Board has put an incredible amount of time and energy into that particular issue, and I guess I would be reluctant to see us usurp their authority unnecessarily, knowing that they are doing due diligence. And so I just kind of want to frame our conversations here as to theoretically we could do whatever we want and we could require you to do certain things, but at the same time, I don't want to step on the expertise of the certified SMART folks who are already dealing with this issue. So,
other questions? House members?
Chair Hass, yes, thank you. Duncan, first of all, please extend my thanks to the other people on the State Board for doing this work. This is, I think, really important to be doing this comprehensive kind of look. You're right, it was very angst-generating, to have request after request after request. And ultimately, I think some kind of comprehensive solution needs to come up. So is your sense that the board can handle this on its own, or does the board feel that it needs help from the legislature?
That, Mr. Chair,
whether or not we listen,
I'm going to be totally honest. I don't know. We put this report out, and Cindy Hunt, who's, I guess she's not in the room, but our lawyer, we're trying to understand the range of authority. What we want to do is work with you. I mean, we clearly need to have a conversation. This is a big deal, and we're not. But we need to have a conversation about what the right framework is on this issue. But I'm not. I'm really not quite clear on what the range of authority is at this point. And because we put out this report, not really looking at the details of the. We were really trying to think what makes sense, and then from there to really go back and what changes in our rules or in the law would be required to make this work. It would clearly have some. I mean, I would just say I know the staff is. If I don't say this, they'll probably shoot me. But there's clearly some budget issues around just running this program at the department level. If we were to do it, because if we were to have some kind of review of applications, we'd have to have some resources to do that. So there's certainly, but there and likely to be, and there could well be statutory changes as well. I just don't know. And we'll keep working with you as we go here.
I just wanted to note on Representative Dembro's question that in your conclusion, in your recommendation, it says the board would adopt a rule.
Yeah.
This is how
yeah.
your model would
right.
work. So.
Right. Yeah, that's true. And we, I mean, I think that would be, whether it's by legislation or not, we would need to have a rule on this. I mean, and,
right.
And the,
okay.
Thank you. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, panel. Appreciate it very much. All right. I'm going to close the informational hearing. And we're going to go through some bills here with invited testimony only on these bills. And then, although this wasn't our plan, I know that some people had traveled ways to get here. And we're going to try to accommodate as many people as we can after we go through these three bills. I hope that's okay. I want your first trip, if it is, to the Capitol to be a successful one. And I hope that this is an education for all of you. It's also positive. So I'd like to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 767. Lori Hamer Whalen is here, yes. Lori Wimmer. Welcome.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing the Oregon Education Association. It's 48,000 members. And we are one of several requesters from the education community who have brought before you the bill that you referred to, Senate Bill 767. As it's drafted, it's sort of a placeholder. There are amendments underway that will correct some clerical and technical changes, incorporate some other good ideas, and so on. So this is not the final version of that policy, but it is a beginning point. And it is jointly being sponsored by several members of the House and Senate. To give you a little background, we've been working on this issue since 2005, the public education community has, and have worked on Senate Bill 1071, which was the virtual school bill passed in 2005. And I have served on the Oregon Virtual School Advisory Council at the Department of Ed since that time. We believe that this is not a matter of whether or not to offer virtual education in a public school setting, but rather how, by whom, and in what ways to maximize student achievement, to be fiscally sound, and so on. And so what came out of our concerns over the way 1071 was being deployed resulted in this bill. What it does is it clarifies the legislative intent, which we believe was the intent of in part, 1071, in addition to creating the Oregon Virtual School District. The residency cap was put in place as a more modest version of the original brick-and-mortar charter school residency cap, which you've heard earlier today was 80% before it sunset. And in fact, if waivers are granted in 100% of the cases as they have been, it is essentially a paper tiger. It is, in fact, not serving as a residency cap at all, if it's always granted. And so we believe that that was never the intent and was a loophole that was created when the virtual school law was overlaid by the charter school law. Had we known that that would be what the practice would be, and it was not a part of the conversation in testimony on the original bill, we would have made sure that it ended up on that brick-and-mortar charter school 1999 unwaivables list. We just didn't realize it was going to go there. So this bill chiefly clarifies legislative intent with respect to that piece. It also does a few other things. It mirrors what Chair Duncan Weiss just told you was a condition that they just put on the waiver they gave ORVA, that the sending district for these students sign off on the enrollment in a virtual program out of district. It also limits the flow of taxpayer resources to elementary programs where an in-house adult must be present in order for the virtual student to enroll. We believe that if you are a single-parent household or a low-income household, you can't afford to have a parent in the home all the time, and that you end up with an economic inequity of access using public resources. So unless the virtual school program is done in conjunction with the classroom setting, those dollars ought not, public dollars ought not flow that way because there are equity questions around that. We will be coming in our hearing on this bill that we originally intended to have with a number of expert witnesses, including an educational psychologist who will also discuss with you implications around brain development and some of the research of overexposure to technology. I know we sometimes get infatuated in an unexamined way with technology as a learning tool, but there are trade-offs and pros and cons if you sacrifice relational learning. And finally, we have quality standards that we have taken out of House Bill 2517 on the House side, sponsored by Representative Arnie Roblin, that we thought were good common sense quality indicators, and so we put them in 767 as well. So as I said, there are more amendments coming. We certainly want to work with the committee to shape this bill in a way that thoughtfully considers the fiscal implications for all districts. We hate to serve the few at the expense of the many, and that's what tends to happen if we don't, in a thoughtful way, make sure that the funding for all students and meeting all their needs is done in a way that doesn't rob from one to pay for the other. And in the case of the state school fund, those funds are allocated by ways and means based on an assumption about how many students are coming to the brick-and-mortar public schools, and the state school fund is distributed accordingly. And what happens when homeschoolers enroll in one of these programs, and most, if not all of them, are, in fact, homeschoolers, some of them come out of public programs. In effect, they are taking money that was allocated to a district for one set of students and rerouting that money for other kids. And so that's what I mean by advantaging some at the expense of the many. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Committee? Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One question, Lori. You, and maybe I missed pieces of it here. You talked about one of the amendments that you're looking at introducing, touching on the equity issue of single parents and how the needs of kids are met in that home. Talk to me a little bit about that, because I think I missed an element in there. I'm not following it yet.
Sure. Mr. Chair and Representative Springer, that was not in an amendment. It's in the original bill. We contemplate that public resources ought to go to middle school and high school programs if the schools are using public resources to pay for online all-day programs. That in the elementary setting, you can't have a five-year-old staying home alone and sitting with a laptop getting an education. You've got to have a learning coach or some sort of adult presence in the home, and that's a barrier to participation for folks who can't afford to have a stay-at-home parent or other adult who is willing to make that kind of commitment 40 hours a week every day, for the child's education. It's just not safe for kids to be home alone.
Okay. Thank you.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair, if I may?
Sure.
Thank you very much.
And I do want to move through these bills because we've got lots of people.
I'll be very brief then. So I heard in there an inference that the education needs to take place during daytime hours. I'm sure the education could take place also in evening hours.
Mr. Chair and Representative Springer, it may be very well that the student can access the computer during an evening hour, but the programs that I know of that are operating in Oregon, while they argue asynchronous learning, and that's a lovely thought, their staff is providing banking hours. So they are not accessing the teachers who are hired in an asynchronous way. Thank you.
Okay.
Just a comment. Just so we tend to get into conspiracy theories here, but I guarantee you, Lori, that when we created the charter law in 1999, we had no idea this was coming at us. So.
That's right.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
I can close the public hearing on Senate Bill 767 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 829. And I believe you have Mr. Krupp. Were you testifying on this bill?
829. I think there are others, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We have you on the list.
I'll decline this time.
Okay. Then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 829, and I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 931. Don Lee, K-12, Inc. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Don Lee. First of all, Mr. Chairman, thank you for giving me the opportunity to, and specifically Senator Morris, the opportunity to introduce Senate Bill 931. First, I'd like to thank all the parents to be here. I think they initially wanted to have the hearing like at 8 o'clock tonight because I think that would have been a better hour for them, but I just want to make this brief to give them out the opportunity to give their testimony. So what Senate Bill 931 does is it basically combines what I believe is kind of taking all the elements of the concerns that I've heard through discussions with all the stakeholders throughout Oregon over the years on the issues related to virtual education, and that is who should be providing these multi-district programs, what accountability measures should be involved, what quality measures, accountability and quality measures should be involved, what kind of parent access should be available, financial transparency, and also to make sure that there's a certified teacher and that's overseeing the process in a good school. And what we did was, many states have gone through exactly the same type of dialogue that you're going through here this afternoon. And I've compiled some, I believe, our best practices of a lot of the states. And basically what this does is it develops a certification system through the State Department of Education and by the State Board of Education. And if you look at the FAQ sheet that's being handed out, it basically answers many of the questions, and that is, there's a certification process with several quality indicators. So there's a quality aspect that's built into this. And it then requires these multi-district programs that are certified by the State Board of Education to, on an annual basis, give a report that on several accountability aspects or indicators, such as academic progress of the children, where they complete the courses, the demographics of the students, the number of teachers employed, all kinds of parameters and built-in quality and accountability standards for the certification of a program that wants to be multi-district. It basically opens up the field for those who want to provide multi-district programs, and that includes a school district if they want to have a multi-district program. An ESD can choose to do one within, of course, their individual ESD district, or they can do a multi-district program statewide as well, as can a charter school of either the State Board of Education or a district. So basically it opens it up to where anybody can choose to provide these multi-district programs as long as they're certified and accountable from a statewide authority, being the State Board of Education. And it also has built into it financial transparency. It requires that these programs have one account set aside specifically for revenues for the program, and only expenditures that are relevant specifically to that program can be expended out of that budget, and then it has to be rolled over from year to year. So all the monies that are come in for these children, that they're actually spent for these programs, so it has a financial transparency aspect. And then third, it builds in what we call a virtual instruction advisory council, and that's kind of a peer review type of council that reports to the State Board of Education and is appointed by the Superintendent of Public Instruction. And these are the people who are the stakeholders of both the education and the virtual community, and they're kind of the eyes and the ears and the source of and reference to the State Board as to how they feel the rules are adequately addressing the system, the state laws. They report how they think the progress are going, the quality in their opinion of the programs, and so on and so forth. And that goes on for as an advisory council for a couple of years, and then there's a sunset provision for that group, or to reassess their role. It also funds this whole oversight through a very small percentage of the ADMW of the full-time virtual multi-district students, and then at 0.5% of their ADMW, and that would basically pay for the oversight through the Department of Education to oversee this program. What we believe this does is it basically creates a trade-off of what we've been hearing is, up to this point, is there's really no policy that's really surrounding the virtual programs or virtual education in Oregon. And what this does is it puts that belt and suspenders on the system of accountability, quality, certification, and also allows an option for the parents to have access and a choice in their public school that their children go to, which in other states we found to be a huge indicator. This is not something that's for everybody. This tightens the net of public education. There's still going to be some children, unfortunately, that fall through that net. This tightens that net and catches some of those children from falling through. And if you restrict the access that these children have to this option, you're going to loosen that net even more, and more children will fall through that public education net and be lost. And that's basically the bill in a nutshell, and I call that my elevator speech at a high building. So I'm open for any questions from the committee, Mr. Chairman.
I appreciate you coming forward. You're with K-12, the company.
I am. I'm Senior Director of Government Affairs with K-12, and a little bit about my background. I was elected 4 terms to the Colorado State House of Representatives, served on the Education Committee. And so I know what it's like to be on that side of the dais. And so I understand this is a difficult decision on your part, but, it basically boils down to, what's good for the child and what's good for the system. And no, this is not a territorial policy that I'm presenting to you today through Senator Morris. This is a policy that, I believe is child-centered. Quite frankly, people are saying that, for-profits are bad, that this is a vendor type of bill. We have over 55,000 public school students nationwide and 300 in Oregon. If you folks decide that you don't want for-profits or you don't want virtual education in Oregon, K-12 will not fold their doors tomorrow. We're here because we have parents that want to have access to our program, and we're here on the behalf of the parents of Oregon that want that opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're with K-12, Inc.?
That's correct.
I wonder if you could just talk, and I know we're really short on time, but I wonder if you could address, you talked about the high level. You're a company that has proprietary curriculum, and to the best of my understanding, a pretty significant marketing team that sort of promotes your corporate brand. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how that approach, that marketing approach and your proprietary curriculum are consistent with sort of the historical fundamentals of public education.
I guess, could you describe what historical fundamentals of education that you're referring to?
Well, the history of public education and the philosophy of providing public education to
students. One of the things, Mr. Chair and Senator Bonamici, is that we've discovered is the most compelling, quote, marketing that we have is word of mouth, and that's between parents that are very very pleased with the services and products that we provide. We have about 95% plus satisfaction from parents that use our curriculum and go to the schools that we service, and by far the majority of parents that enroll in our schools come through just talking to friends and family in the community. And very, very little is actually comes through the branding image and code marketing. We're actually doing a lot less in a lot of ways in marketing because of that. Once we're established in the state, it's basically the word of mouth that brings the parents to us.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Just like any other public school. You hear about them, right? It's a good school, when you're talking to folks.
Well, thank you. Appreciate a sneak peek to your bill, and I know you have amendments to the original.
Right.
We'll hear more on this one. Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 931, and we are running very short on time, so I will call the following people up. And we will start with Shannon Long and Sheridan Long, Janelle Thomas, Laura Dillon Terre. If you could come up to the panel and tell us your story and just a. And I will.
He's got confused.
And I will let you speak, if it's okay, under the hearing of Senate Bill 829. So I'm going to open a public hearing on 829.
Oh, okay. Now, yes. This was trying to follow.
Okay. I'm going to introduce my daughter, Sheridan Long. We are constituents in Senator Morse and Representative Gelser's district. And I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to her. She's got some prepared remarks that she's going to read to you guys.
Oregon Connections Academy, ORCA, is a good school and over 2,000 students from Oregon are enrolled there. I am one of ORCA's students. I am 9 years old and I am in 6th grade and taking mostly 7th grade courses. This is possible because ORCA is a virtual school. ORCA means a lot to me because it is my first public school. I have gotten to know the teachers and students there and I enjoy the curriculum. I need ORCA because ORCA is my only option other than homeschooling. It is very dangerous for me to go to a regular school because I have life-threatening allergies to several common foods, and I don't even have to eat those foods to have a fatal reaction. However, if the 50-50 provision goes into effect, ORCA will have to remove students until half of its students come from Shire, the school district ORCA is in. ORCA is not stealing students from public schools. For one thing, ORCA is a public school. For another, many of the students that ORCA enrolls every year were originally or otherwise would be homeschoolers. Even though ORCA has many former homeschoolers in the school, it is not homeschooling. ORCA uses much of the same curriculum as brick and mortar schools. They use highly qualified teachers from around the state of Oregon to teach their students. These teachers are also teaching their specialties. ORCA also requires students to meet the standards of any other public school. They are required to take state tests, meet PEU requirements, and complete schoolwork each day or be considered truants. I also like ORCA because multiple teachers give students different learning experiences, and therefore students can explore diverse learning styles. Increasing learning flexibility is another thing that multiple teachers does for students. In homeschooling, you often have only one teacher, the stay-at-home parents. Also, as a family with one stay-at-home parent, we might not be able to afford all of the brand new textbooks ORCA sends us every year if I was homeschooled. If I were homeschooled, I could not get recommended by my school for talent searches by colleges and universities with programs for gifted students. I also need multiple teachers to write recommendations for me for summer activities intended for talented and gifted students. As a homeschooled student, it was hard to get into programs at the appropriate level. For kids who are a lot younger than their academic peers, ORCA allows them to make friends with other kids that might shun them if they knew how young and how small they were compared to themselves. Kids with all kinds of differences don't face that same level of rejection in ORCA. It's easier to fit in when your physical differences don't matter because they are invisible. Kids like me would probably be rejected by their academic peers if they were in a conventional school. So please support virtual schools in Oregon. Help kids like me keep going to school to ORCA.
Thank you, Shannon.
This is Sheridan.
Yes, Sheridan.
I understand the confusion, though. Well, now that you've met my daughter. You did a good job.
Have you done that a lot before?
No. She did it with much more aplomb when she was speaking to Susan Castillo, however. She's a little nervous today. Now that you've met my child, let me talk a little more succinctly about exactly what the disadvantages to a brick-and-mortar placement would be for her. I understand the concerns raised by the OEA regarding placement of children in virtual programs at the elementary level. But there's another side to this, and it has to do with children whose special needs prevent them from accessing that environment in the first place. My child is one of those children. Her safety alone dictates some really substantial changes to a brick-and-mortar environment. I will list them in order. Restrictions on other students, staff, and family. I don't have a choice. This is my child's life. She's one of those kids, and yes, I'm one of those parents. You don't get a choice when you're given a special needs child. You don't get to opt out, and you don't ever get a vacation from it. That makes you a pretty potent advocate. I would need a full-time nurse at my child's school. And while I appreciate that the legislature is trying to do something about that, that is far from reality in most of Oregon. And right now, from a fiscal standpoint, I just don't think it's the time. I wish that were not true. It's probably also safe to say that a one-to-one paraprofessional is not out of the question for my child. This is all adding up, isn't it? That's a lot of money. There are other things that probably would be necessary for her to simply access the environment on a day-to-day basis. That would all be negotiated probably in an IEP. She doesn't need an IEP with ORCA because she is covered under a 504 plan instead. The state never assumes the duty of care for her because of the environment that is provided through virtual education. That's a significant liability savings for the state, if nothing else. She is not alone. There are other students like her. Academically, obviously, is our second concern. I would not like to see my 9-year-old placed in the average middle school environment. And I think all of you as parents can understand why. I want her to be 9. I also want her to be able to do algebra because she's good at it. She enjoys it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Thomas, it looks like you've got a growing contingent there. Yeah,
there's another one in the stroller that didn't come up with me. Chair Haas, Chair Gelser, and the members of the committee, I'm Janelle Thomas. This is half of my brood. We drove up from Central Point yesterday to see you, so I appreciate the fact that you're hearing us. As a mother of 4 children and as a member of the Oregon Virtual Public School Alliance, board member, I did say, I'm here, obviously, today to express my concern about virtual public schools and the future of them. My family's personal educational experience is a combination of both virtual schools and brick-and-mortar schools. The brick-and-mortar school was not able to challenge this son's accelerated learning abilities. And after one full year in the brick-and-mortar atmosphere, he had not gained any academic growth whatsoever, and he ended that year with a true dislike, not for learning, but for the one-size-fits-all repetitive manner of education that we see in the brick-and-mortar schools today. And that form of education that was forced upon him and his peers, and the excitement that he had for learning before I put him in brick-and-mortar school, in 9 months, all but disappeared. The traditional brick-and-mortar schools today are not structured to meet the needs of every child's learning abilities, regardless of whether they're struggling or excelling. This was certainly proven in our case, and virtual school is the right public education choice for me and my family and my children. The educational choice should be in the hands of us as parents and as families. Those of us who are concerned about the quality of education for our children deserve the right to choose which public school they attend. I know that at this point in time, my sons are receiving the highest quality education available to them. I know what they learn every day. I know what their homework is. I know what they didn't learn in the day. I know where they are every minute of their education. They're also receiving the quality of education with a curriculum that meets the standards for every state in our nation, which is pretty special, I think. They love school, they now love learning, and every day they're eager to see what new knowledge awaits them. And because of the changes in today's fast-paced world, our brick-and-mortar schools are unable to accommodate every child at every learning level. virtual and virtual charter schools should be looked upon as an opportunity for our brick-and-mortar schools to focus more intently on the mainstream kids and educate them to their fullest potential. Students who attend the virtual and virtual charter schools are often the students that create situations that are outside of the mainstream box in a brick-and-mortar classroom. There's two of them right here. When he was at reading at an 11th grade, second month level, when I put him in second grade. Again, do you want to put either of these children in with 13 and 14-year-olds? Because that was the solution that my brick-and-mortar school had for me. Not an okay solution. In closing, I hope that each of you will give serious consideration to the question at hand. In our public school system today, are we truly concerned with what is best for the children, or are we concerned instead of what's best for the system? Are we teaching children in the manner that they learn today, or in the manner in which we as a society have been comfortable teaching our children for centuries? Technology is at our fingertips. It's a brand new world. We need to keep up with that. The world's changing every moment, and new methods of education are available worldwide. Oregon's a progressive state, and it is my sincere hope that you, our elected officials, will choose to be progressive as well. Give parents the right to choose the proper education for their children. Thank you for the opportunity again and for the time to share our stories. Any questions?
Well, we thank both of you for coming up and traveling, and this is valuable for us.
One final note before I go. There was mention made earlier about this net of public education that needs to capture more children, not fewer. And my child was one that slipped through the net. We weren't homeschoolers because we liked homeschooling. We were homeschoolers because we didn't have another option. And I think it's important to recognize that this is a net that can close some of those gaps. It's very important not to lose sight of that. I understand that you need to look at the very big picture here to see what's going to work in the long term for Oregon as a state. But please don't forget about kids who are in the system now while you're doing that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Laura?
Yes.
I'd like to conclude with Laura and Paula Foster and Skyla Bendorf, if you could come up. And I thank you for traveling. I thank you for being considerate of our very strict time limits that we have here.
Thank you. My name is Laura Dillon, and I'm a kindergarten teacher at Oregon Connections Academy. Chairman Haas and members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to speak to you today. This is my third year as a teacher at ORCA. Previous to that, I taught in Amity for 9 years as a fourth and fifth grade teacher and 1 year of kindergarten. I also taught in SIO for 2 years as a Title I reading specialist, and I subbed in the Corvallis, Jefferson, and SIO school districts. And this is a total of 14 years as a public school teacher. And I'm happy to share a little bit of my experiences with you. While at Oregon Connections Academy, I've had the privilege to teach children from all over the state of Oregon, like the children who attended my classrooms in Amity, SIO, Jefferson, and Corvallis. They're all eager learners who come from varied backgrounds. It's an absolute privilege to have an opportunity to work with students of diverse cultural, geographic, academic, and social backgrounds. Through program flexibility and individual student attention, I'm able to reach each child according to his or her unique needs. As you've seen today, we have medically fragile children like Sheridan Long. We have children who are in and out of Dornbecker Hospital. And we have incredibly gifted children. We also have families who are foster parents, families living in rural settings and large settings. My kindergartners experience and complete a quality curriculum that meets national and state standards. The reading series is print-rich and very colorful. The core curriculum subjects and electives ranging from sign language to chess club and others are interwoven to provide a school day that is varied, it's high caliber, it's inclusive of text and internet resources, and it ensures direct teacher contact. many people here that virtual schooling assumes that the children are online all day, and that is not the case. I can tell you from my experience, and for children in kindergarten through fifth grade in the virtual school, it does not mean sitting in front of a computer and learning from the computer. In our curriculum, students spend the majority of their day working away from the computer. They work on art projects, they perform science experiments, they complete workbook activities, and they read a variety of literature books. As I review my students every morning on my homepage, I can quickly assess who needs my immediate attention with a phone call or a live lesson in my virtual classroom, and I am able to complete my regular teacher tasks and give individual attention to all my students. I love teaching. I love teaching in Oregon. I love teaching in the public school setting, and I do love teaching at Oregon Connections Academy. I get to personalize each child's learning through a personal learning plan, and the learning coach and I develop goals for their student to focus on during the school year. During our regular phone conversations, we discuss these goals and the progress the child has made throughout the year. The learning coaches for my students play an integral part in their students' education. We work closely together to help the child achieve their goals and evolve into a 21st century learner. Through our phone calls and emails and live lessons, and we have a partnership, a relationship that benefits the whole child. They understand that I am the one to grade their students' work, I'm the one to modify the curriculum if needed, and assess their students' abilities. It is a partnership that works both from a teaching perspective and, I believe, for the family, too. Families of Oregon Connections Academy students enjoy the flexibility of schooling at home, the accountability of a public school education that utilizes rigorous curriculum and employs certified, highly qualified teachers. Our families are grateful to have our school as a choice for their child's education. And as Arne Duncan was quoted in the Chicago Tribune, he says, "It is our job to listen to children, to listen to parents, and create new, great new options that never before existed." And I believe in the state of Oregon, that's our job as well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Ms. Foster?
Oh, me. All right. Well, my name is Paula Foster, and I'm from Hillsborough. Thank you for hearing us out today. My first introduction to Oregon public schooling was 4 years ago when I enrolled in my children in Oregon Connections Academy. Prior to that, they were homeschooled. I would like to emphasize to you today that ORCA is not homeschooling, and while I'm using this public school, I will not consider myself a homeschooler. I am held responsible, I am held accountable, and I am personally supervised by someone other than myself. Just to enroll, I have to submit my children's immunization forms, my children's academic records, my children's disciplinary report, my proof of residency, my children's official birth certificates, a learning coach agreement, and a family information form. I have to agree to have my children take the OAKS test, the LEAP assessment test twice a year, and administer the multitude of unit tests and quizzes within the curriculum. I have 180 days to complete 180 days of work. I have biweekly communication with the teachers, mandatory assignments to submit, an icon that tells me what my children's performance rating is, and there are even follow-ups on disenrollment. I have one more thing to share before I close. This circumstance impressed me the most about Oregon public schooling. I call it Jesse the Dropout Story. My eldest son, Jesse, was enrolled in ORCA for 2 years. At 15, his birthday's in the summer. He decided that PCC was more of his thing. He did this because he found out, from a military recruiter that with 22 credits from PCC, he could transfer to OSU to the ROTC program and enter military service as an officer. Oh, without a thought, I allowed my son to enroll in PCC that fall term. That fall term, I got a call from ORCA asking me what happened to my son and what educational path he chose. They were concerned about him graduating with a diploma and at least getting our GED. When I told my son that I was going to tell you the Jesse the Dropout story, he smiled. This is emotional for me. He turned to me and he said, "Mom, that sounds kind of odd, but the real dropout story you should be telling is about my buddy Josh." Josh decided to really drop out of high school. And had it not been for Orca, the system would have lost him. I choose Orca because it provides structure and a program that utilizes all the learning styles of my kids. Excuse me. Orca gives my children an identity and a sense of community. I have peace of mind knowing that my children complete all assignments, 180 days worth. And should my child need extra help, I have instant communication via phone, webmail, computer conferencing with a highly qualified teacher. And Orca keeps me disciplined as well. And I don't mind these restrictions because for me and my family, we just come out way ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Bendor?
Yes, thank you for the opportunity to address you today. My name is Skyla Bendor, and I am on the board of directors of Oregon Virtual Schools, Public Schools Alliance, sorry. And I am also the parent of a kindergartner and the learning coach for her. Mrs. Dillon is my daughter's teacher. I'd like to share briefly our family story, and then I'd like to read a letter that was sent by the president of Oregon Virtual Public Schools Alliance, Angie Armstrong.
Ms. Bendor, it might be more helpful if you just submitted that letter to
Absolutely.
Them without reading it.
Our story is much more average. We don't have any special needs. My child does not have medical needs or academic needs. I knew when I was pregnant with my child that I wanted to participate in her education. I am a stay-at-home parent because I want to raise my children. I don't have a problem with brick-and-mortar public schools. I have had no bad experiences. I chose this path very deliberately. I want to be the one to teach my child to read, to write. I want to teach her mathematics. I want to teach her the history of our country. I want to be the person to do that. And that is why I started looking into homeschooling when she was still an infant. And I was very unsatisfied with what is available out there. And I don't mean to disparage homeschooling programs either, but there was nothing out there that gave me the structure and the materials that I find with Oregon Connections Academy. We are given fantastic curriculum. My daughter thinks that her school books are fun books. We take them on trips, and she loves to work in them. We spend 2 hours a day. I spend 2 hours a day with my child face-to-face educating her. And in addition to that, she spends a few hours online every week turning in tests. She talks to Mrs. Dillon frequently. This has been a fantastic, very positive experience for us. My daughter is doing great. She is passing all of her tests. There is an added quality to our relationship, my relationship with her as a parent, because I get to teach her. And I very much want to request that I have access to this. I don't want to send my child to a brick-and-mortar school, and I don't want to be left with only the option of homeschooling. I'm not a teacher. I wouldn't know how to pull the curriculum together. I wouldn't know how to do that. What I am is her mother, and I know that this is the best situation for her. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Ms. Bendor. Appreciate you and everyone else who came here. We are on all of these bills. We'll have plenty more opportunities, more bites of the apple, which seems like an appropriate metaphor here today. And this is a very complicated issue for the state to weigh in on. As you know, there's more than one component here, and the only guarantee I can give you today is that we're going to be thoughtful in how we approach this. Very helpful to see you all and to hear from you all, and I hope that you'll keep your engagement going as we work through this. So thank you all. And I will close our hearing on Senate Bill 829. And I will adjourn the Senate Committee on Education. We'll take a 2-minute break and reopen and deal with IPMs.